Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. It's December of 1829. It's cold and gray in Paris, France, and a man's body is being dumped without much ceremony.
He was put in a pit of lime.
In a mass grave at Montparnasse Cemetery.
At the end, he was blind and penniless.
So poor, he couldn't afford a proper Catholic funeral. It was a stunning fall from grace for Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, once a war hero and respected scientist, a botanist and zoologist. He coined the term invertebrate and did other groundbreaking work. For example, long before Darwin, Lamarck came up with a different hypothesis about evolution.
Traits that you accumulate over your life can be passed on to your offspring.
I talked about Lamarck with Peter Ward. He is a professor of biology at the University of Washington, Seattle. Peter says Lamarck was discredited by a jealous colleague, dismissed, misunderstood. And then in 1859, Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species that introduced a different take on evolution. And Lamarck became nothing but a footnote.
Whenever Lamarck is mentioned, and generally he gets a paragraph before Darwin, and it's Lamarck is pointed out as that foolish man with this bad theory. Here's what evolution is, and Lamarck is what evolution wasn't or isn't. And laugh, 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 poor Lamarck.
But now with our advancing knowledge of genetics and specifically epigenetics, Peter says there is a new interest in Lamarck's ideas.
There's a great comeback for his theories.
Comebacks aren't just for athletes and washed-up actors. Ideas make comebacks, so do scientists and species. Grizzly bears are rebounding in Canada. Wine is growing once again in the Israeli desert. And even UFO science is making it into the mainstream. On this episode, a look at comebacks, how they happen, why they happen, and what fuels them. Okay, first, let's stick with Jean-Baptiste Lamarck and his ideas for a moment. Biologist Peter Ward is pushing for a comeback. He's written a book called Lamarck's Revenge to get people to give Lamarck's thoughts on evolution a second look. So to repeat, Lamarck's basic idea is this. There's adaptive change in species and
traits that you accumulate over your life can be passed on to your offspring.
I asked Peter to explain this take on evolution a little bit more.
Evolution is driven by several things, but the most important of the first steps is that the environment changes. Major change, great temperature swings, or the chemistry of the ocean, or just any sort of physical change is the first step along the way. Step two, and this is where he departs from Darwinian work. Step two is the change in environment causes an animal to change its behavior.
And step three, the changed behavior results in physical changes, in new traits. Give me an example of a trait that an animal could pick up over its lifetime. I'm thinking about the giraffe.
Well, that is the tragedy. The greatest single tragedy of Lamarck is that darn giraffe example. It's in every textbook, but the giraffe aspect is so misunderstood by so many people. The thought is that the giraffe sees leaves above its head and it starts stretching its neck. And over the lifetime of that giraffe, as it stretches its neck, it gives rise to baby giraffes, which have a slightly longer neck because of the stretching of the parent. Well, that's how it's interpreted. That's the easy way we look at this. And that's absolutely wrong. What Lamarck would have said about giraffes is that is there more food above them or below? And giraffes do feed out of trees. If there were some sort of vegetation change and all of a sudden there were more leaves above, way up there, the behavior of giraffes might start being that they're going to look up for food more and more and more. It's not that stretching that causes the change. He would say then we're finding out more and more that much of behavior is coded genetically as well.
Peter says now there's this whole field of epigenetics where scientists examine factors like pollution, nutrition, or stress and how they impact DNA and turn genes on or off. And with that, he says, Lamarck's ideas deserve a second look. Now, to be sure, many scientists are not on board with this comeback. One critic called Lamarck's ideas zombies that just won't die. But we are talking about him again, right?
I think there are many geniuses that are overlooked in this particular way.
Peter Ward is a biologist. His book is Lamarck's Revenge: How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. We're talking about comebacks on The Pulse, ideas, fields of research, and here are three words I never thought I would say on this show: unidentified flying objects, UFOs. But yes, they are making a comeback, maybe not literally, but in terms of how they are being studied. I mean, you know something has shifted when you read about UFOs in the New York Times. So how is UFO science coming back? Alan Yu explains.
First, I talk to people who want to believe in UFOs, so I go to a UFO conference. This is a meeting for the Pennsylvania chapter of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, a nonprofit that has been investigating UFO sightings since 1969. It's a place where people can kind of get away from eye-rolling that's associated with UFO talk.
We don't make fun of each other. We take this very seriously.
That's Sarah Carrion Park, a nurse from New York. She has already been to 5 of these conferences.
I have many friends who are open to the topic. They don't ridicule me to my face, and I'm pretty sure they don't do it behind my back, but they're very skeptical.
Brian McMahon used to think this was, quote, crap.
I didn't give it enough credit to see it as an actual science, more of a pseudoscience, but now I'm starting to see it as it being realistic.
He's here with his fiancée, Courtney Evans, who has always been a believer.
When I told them at work I was going on a vacation, they said, ooh, where are you going? I'm like, oh, I'm going to an alien convention. And they were like, oh, cool.
Some of the presentations and books are a bit fringe, talking about time travel, quote, who built the moon, and how aliens are living among us right now. But remember, a UFO does not mean an alien spaceship. A UFO is an unidentified flying object, a thing in the sky that we're not sure about. John Doucette says that's what the group investigates. He's the state director of the Pennsylvania chapter.
There have been a lot of investigations that we've determined were totally natural. And, you know, we explained it to the people that made the report, and we're able to do that. No, this is a naturally occurring phenomenon. This is not a UFO. You know, thank you for your report. And, you know, we explained to them why and what it is. My favorite is reflections off of lenses from cell phone cameras and digital cameras. So they see spots or orbs in the air, and it's dirt on their lens. And they'll say, look at all those orbs. No, that's dirt. Because when they track with it, you can see the dirt is moving with them.
The government used to do this work of checking out UFO reports.
The Air Force program called Project Blue Book, which was investigating UFOs, they closed in early 1970s. It was completely shut down. And that was really like sort of when the golden age of UFOs, in a sense, ended.
That's Leslie Kane. She's an investigative journalist and has written a book about UFOs. She says the end of this program left kind of a void that groups like the Mutual UFO Network filled. The CIA got worried that people were taking this UFO thing too seriously. They recommended a public education campaign to spread the word that there's no evidence behind UFOs and you're a bit of a sucker if you believe in them.
What they said was we're going to infiltrate UFO groups. They talked about impacting television and commercials and you know, schools and education and all these different areas within the culture to sort of play down the UFO phenomenon. And the way to do that was to make it seem like a joke, to just diminish its impact on people. That kind of became integrated into the culture.
And it worked.
It is an issue in the culture that most people think it's little green men and flying saucers and ha, ha, ha. these are the people that have no information, that are uninformed about what the phenomenon actually is and what we know about it.
Leslie investigates the most credible UFO sightings, ones made by observers like pilots, and are backed up by actual evidence. She says if we dismiss all UFO sightings as conspiracy theories about aliens, we will also throw out some legitimately mysterious phenomena that we should study. She points to one example from O'Hare International Airport in Chicago in 2006.
One of the busiest airports in the United States, around 4:30 in the afternoon, still daylight, a normal day. There was a little bit of a drizzle, I think a little bit of a haze, but you could see very well. And for about at least 5 minutes, it might have been longer, there was a metallic-looking disc that was just hovering over gate C-17 at the United Airlines terminal at Chicago O'Hare Airport in the middle of the rush hour day. You know, it's 4:30 in the afternoon. This thing was just seen hovering there.
Pilots, luggage handlers, and mechanic, they all saw this thing. It was covered widely in the media, but I couldn't find any credible pictures. But remember, this was before the first iPhone came out. A United Airlines manager called the control tower operator. Leslie got a hold of a recording, and she gave it to a documentary crew.
But I'm not high and I'm not drinking.
Yeah.
Someone actually has a picture of it, so if you guys see it out there.
A disc. Like a frisbee?
Like a UFO type thing.
The tower operator was joking with this person and saying, what, you know, have you been drinking? And, oh, you're talking about a flying saucer, ha, ha, ha. And it was very, very disturbing because this manager was reporting a safety hazard that was being seen over the airport. And because it was a UFO, she said it looks like a UFO, the people in the tower were treating it as a joke. So all of a sudden, the object shot straight up through the sky really fast, just from a still hovering position to zooming straight up through the sky. And it cut a clear hole in the cloud bank above it. So this, it was almost like a cookie cutter just cutting through dough. There was this crisp hole. And when you stood underneath that hole on the ground, you could look up through the cloud bank and see the blue sky on the other side of it. Now, this is something that we don't have technology that is known to anybody I've talked to that can do something like that.
The Federal Aviation Administration first said it was a reflection from airport lights, which Leslie says were turned off. Then the FAA said it was a particular type of cloud. But Leslie says those clouds only form in freezing temperatures, and it was 50 degrees that day.
The explanations were both ridiculous, but it was also ridiculous and insulting to the witnesses who were trained observers to doubt what they said they saw. None of these pilots would put their names on the record. And that was because they were afraid of repercussions from their airline or that it might affect their jobs.
But Leslie says that's changing. We have these reports from credible observers, and even the military is taking this seriously again.
In the last couple of years, we've taken a big step forward in kind of overcoming this climate of ridicule that's been in the culture for many, many years.
Leslie co-reported the two recent stories in the New York Times that revealed the Pentagon had been investigating UFOs for many years, and Navy pilots had seen UFOs and captured some on video.
Oh my gosh! Going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. Cool thing, dude.
The footage is taken from the infrared sensors of U.S. Navy jets 25,000 feet in the air. You can see a white dot, a flying object that starts rotating in mid-air.
Well, if there's like this thing, it's rotating.
In another one, you can see a fast-moving black dot. It's moving so fast, the pilot struggles to get the sensor to keep up with it.
Oh my gosh, dude. Wow,
I asked Vincent Aiello to take a look. He's been a Navy pilot for many years, has flown that exact type of jet, and hosts the Fighter Pilot podcast. He says as far as he can tell, these videos look legit. As for what they captured,
it's unclear to me what these objects are. I'm not prepared to say they are from outer space or another galaxy or planet. I'm not prepared to say that they are man-made either.
That might not sound like much. There's something in the sky and Navy pilots can't tell what it is. but Vincent says that rarely happens.
I flew over 3,800 flight hours in 25 years in the Navy, and I never observed anything in the air that I was unable to identify at some point.
The U.S. Navy recently updated their guidelines for how to report UFOs. Leslie says she's glad the military, and maybe the public, is starting to take these legitimate cases more seriously. The long habit of making fun of UFOs, all these jokes about flying saucers and little green men, it also got in the way of unrelated science. Back in the 50s and 60s, scientists wanted to know if there was other intelligent life in the universe. Not by looking at mysterious objects in our airspace, but by listening for radio signals that could only be sent by a piece of technology, a radio broadcast, rather than, say, a dying star. This was called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI. NASA joined in these efforts and started a formal government-funded program in 1992. Jill Tarter was the project scientist for NASA's SETI program. If you've seen the movie Contact, the main character, played by Jodie Foster, is based on her.
It was really difficult to get people to distinguish this scientific exploration from claims of UFOs and flying saucers. So we spent a lot of time early on creating our credibility and demonstrating it.
In the movie, Jodie Foster's character does make contact.
Right ascension, 18 hours, 36 minutes!
But that did not happen in real life. Congress cut the funds for this research in 1993 by making fun of the research SETI was doing. Senator Richard Bryan joked that, quote, this will be the end of Martian hunting season at the taxpayers' expense.
The Congress voted to remove the funds. It was done in such a malevolent way that we literally became a four-letter S-word that you couldn't say at NASA headquarters for the longest time.
Jill had to find private funding to continue her work. It made the research much harder, but it paid off. And now the landscape has changed. We now know there are thousands of planets outside our solar system, some of which are about the same size as Earth and have similar conditions, so it no longer seems far-fetched to try and find evidence of tech from other planets. Jill has now seen a change in the astronomy papers that she sees.
What I notice is that as a referee of scientific papers and observing proposals, there's almost every paper I look at now contains the word life, where astronomical papers never did early on. So this has been a large change.
For a while, NASA's astrobiology program explicitly said research proposals that look for signs of intelligent life need not apply. But last year, a House Appropriations bill specifically asked NASA to resume the search for alien technology. And it's in this changed climate that legitimate research into UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence, because those are two different things, might be making a comeback.
That was Alan Yu reporting. We're talking about comebacks on The Pulse and how they happen. Ideas, people, science, and species. How do you know if a threatened species is making a comeback? Well, you have to get exact numbers, keep track of them. But when you're talking about grizzly bears, getting good data proves difficult. Reporter Molly Siegel spent time with scientists in the Canadian province of Alberta, just north of Montana, chasing bears for a census of sorts.
A grizzly bear census is complicated, because grizzlies cover vast territories.
Welcome, welcome Thank to camp.
I meet with biologist Gord Stenhouse. He leads a team that goes out and puts radio collars on grizzly bears. Those collars will tell him where a bear is going and where bears are hanging out. But how do you get a collar on a grizzly bear? That is part art, part science. Gord and his team have set up traps all over the area. There are 7 grizzly bear management areas in the province of Alberta. The one we're in is almost the size of Massachusetts. They're hoping to catch maybe 10 to 15 grizzlies this field season.
And we're all waiting for alarms. So we have the alarms come to our phones.
The alarm tells them a trap has been triggered. But before you can catch a bear, you have to bait the trap. So I head out with some of the other field crew to see how it all works. I hop in a truck with John Saunders and Dave Hobson. When they get to a trap, they first make sure there's no bear circling the area around it.
Hey, bear!
They carry a shotgun and make noise.
Well, the birds have cleaned us out again.
It looks like birds have been at the bait. The bear trap is a giant metal pipe. One end is closed off, and on the other is an opening. If a grizzly wiggles its way in and grabs the bait hanging at the end, a trigger goes off and the door will close, trapping the bear inside.
I think we should put new trigger bait on there.
The bait is in the back of the pickup truck, mostly elk that were hit by vehicles in the nearby national park.
Now, I have a knife.
They butcher the elk.
And I have enough to redo that bait.
This is where things get creative. You have to imagine what might be appealing to a bear. John scooches inside the trap to set the trigger with a big, juicy piece of elk.
Everything sort of depends on just tempting that bear to get in that trap. This
is such good. Outside the trap, they scatter pieces of meat here and there, hoist some up into a tree, and garnish it all with fermented blood, which will get caught in the wind and hopefully grab a bear's attention. Last year, this team collected hair from bears in this area. They're analyzing the DNA to get a better sense of how many bears live here. Pair that with the radio collars, and a clearer picture of bear numbers and movements will emerge. This matters for bears and humans. The area where Gord and his team are working covers part of a national park, campgrounds, wilderness, and also towns and farmland. So bears and people occupy some of the same space and sometimes use the same resources here.
For example, if we have more recreation or more human activity in an area, are bears being pushed out or displaced from that area and then being forced into areas where you might have more conflict with agricultural areas or with the ranching community?
Well, if we have a resident bear population that is staying within the ranching area, the ranching community, we need to know that. We'd even get bald eagles.
I meet Paul Fraser in the community of Bearberry, where he and his partner raise yearling cows. Driving to their ranch, you might catch a glimpse of mountains in the distance. Barns and cows dot the rolling hills. But make no mistake, this is also grizzly bear country. And it's part of the area Gord and his team are collaring grizzlies. Paul is a trained wildlife biologist, and he works with local ranchers to prevent conflict between humans and bears.
If they're staying here, we need to manage for them to be here if we want to exist with them. And that's the whole point, is trying to coexist with the bears here. So we got to educate people and let them know, okay, yeah, there are bears here. They are staying here. This is where they're moving around.
But to figure out whether or not grizzlies are staying in that area or just passing through, they need to put collars on bears that are actually spending time on ranch and farmland. And Paul helps Gord find ranchers and farmers who are seeing grizzly bears on their property regularly and who are okay with having a bear trap on their land for a few days. Around here, a couple people have died from grizzly attacks before, so bears can make people feel anxious.
How many bears are on the landscape? They want an absolute number, and we can't give them that. Because everybody's seeing more bears, at least that's what they're saying, is we're seeing way more bears here on the landscape than were here 10 years ago. And we think the bear population is increasing. We think there's potential for human-bear conflict to happen again. So what they would like to see is a hunting season open up for grizzly bears.
It's been illegal to hunt grizzly bears in Alberta since 2006. Gord, the biologist, tells me many grizzlies still get shot and killed in the province illegally.
Some people might be afraid of bears, which I understand at some level, and some people just might not accept that there's grizzly bears coming into areas where they haven't seen them before. You go and speak to a rancher who might have lost a calf or cattle or sheep to a bear, and they might believe there's too many bears.
The bears may be around, but I've yet to see one. It's my last morning at their field camp. I'd really like to be there for the action, how they collar a grizzly bear. And?
So we had an alarm last night, just after midnight, at the site we set yesterday. We called it Wigwam Site on the Wigwam Road. And we hope that there's a bear inside the trap, so we're gonna just go check that.
We drive to Wigwam Road. The team is hopeful, but I'm nervous. An alarm doesn't always mean a bear. The bear could have triggered it and gotten away. When we arrive, Gord gets out of his truck and tells me for now I have to stay put while they approach the trap. I have a mic on him and can hear everything from my spot in the truck.
Yes, indeed, it's a bear. And it's a grizzly bear.
A couple team members prepare a dart with a drug to immobilize the bear.
Good.
The dart hit the target. The grizzly is out cold, and now I can get up close. The bear's breathing is slow. It smells kind of like a wet dog, but stronger. But instead of kibble breath, raw elk breath.
Hey, bear.
They make sure the bear's oxygen levels are good. Then they get to work quickly.
Okay.
They have roughly 1 hour before the bear will wake up.
Okay, Abby, you can start sampling. You're going to be on shotgun? You're on collar.
All five crew members have different tasks and all move swiftly in tandem. They have a list of samples to take.
One of the things we do is pull this little premolar tooth here, that little tiny one. And before we pull it, just like when you're at the dentist, we freeze. So we're putting in some freezing.
They take a tooth the size of my pinky nail, minuscule compared to its other long, sharp teeth. It will tell them how old the bear is. They take blood samples. They pluck and shave tiny bits of hair, which they'll analyze later for many different things, and a small skin biopsy. It sounds like we're in a hospital.
So now we need another round of vitals. So you got rectal temp and respiration, please.
They insert a microchip under its skin.
Yes, we're putting in a microchip.
Each time they catch a bear, they scan it to see if it already has one of these. That would tell them they've caught it before. One of their last tasks, measure and weigh the bear. It clocks in at 338 pounds. Samples taken, measurements done, and collar secured on the bear. They prepare to inject the grizzly with a drug that will wake him up. Suddenly, the bear lets out a huge breath.
When you start hearing those big breaths like that, that means the bear's coming out of the anesthetic plane. So these nice, big, deep breaths, those are really good.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Okay.
And it tells you you should be finishing.
Okay.
Okay.
Just as quickly as the team unpacked, they pack up their gear and we pile into the trucks. Gord will wait in his until the grizzly starts waking up. This bear doesn't know it, but it's become a moving data set that will send them GPS points for up to 2 years, and maybe answer some questions that will help keep grizzly bears like this one in Alberta for years to come.
Molly Siegel reported that story. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about comebacks. Some species make comebacks differently, by way of regeneration. You know, when animals can regrow parts of themselves, like starfish or lizards. That's what molecular biologist Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado studies, and his creature of choice is a flatworm.
The Latin name is Schmittea mediterranea.
They're about the size of a toenail clipping, and they live in freshwater in southern Europe.
You can take these animals and you can cut them into, I don't know, as many as 18 different fragments. And the remarkable thing is that each and every one of those fragments will go on to reshape themselves and produce 18 individual flatworms. That's the equivalent of like me cutting my little finger and watching my little finger regenerate me completely.
And do we have any clue why they have this ability to regenerate? Do they get cut into 18 pieces frequently when out in nature?
They do something some of the species do something that is akin to regeneration, which is they themselves will fission. They'll actually split themselves into two fragments as a way to reproduce. Essentially, they clone themselves in the wild. So the way it works, to describe it, is that they have a little head and a little tail, and the tail serves as an anchor. The head begins to crawl forward, and it stretches almost like a rubber band until it forms a very thin waist that now just snaps. And when it snaps, it produces a headless tail and a tailless head, both of which will actually go on to regenerate complete animals in the span of approximately a week to a week and a half.
And how do they do that? That's amazing.
Yeah, so that's the $1 million question.
Right.
I mean, that is That is the really key question. We have some suspicions based on scientific evidence that a great deal of the regenerative powers are based in the existence of a population of adult stem cells that reside in a fairly random way in their body plan. And we know that these cells are activated upon amputation. We also know that the cells are activated whenever some of the tissues in the animal grow old and die, these cells will divide.
If we understood this process, what could that mean for us humans, for our health?
The hope is that by understanding the life forms that inhabit the planet with us, that will allow us to understand our biology better. And we believe that this is an accurate approach to understanding life because we now know that many of the genes that populate the genomes of these very diverse and very different species from us, we have in our own genome. There's a high degree of similarity between the genes that are present in the planarian genome, the flatworm genome, and in the human genome. So I think that if we understand their biology and how they do this, this will help us inform our own biology and figure out ways to perhaps reactivate those processes or modify them in such a way in our own bodies that we might help mitigate damage to our own tissues or restore missing structures that may be lost to traumatic injury or degenerative diseases or something of the like.
They are a lot less complex than us, obviously, right? And I'm thinking now there are certain things that we also can regrow, like mm-hmm. our fingernails and our hair and our skin.
Yes.
So is it just that we're too complicated to regrow? Like, you know, a human leg is a pretty complicated thing. So I would imagine it would be tough to regrow that.
I agree with you, except that there are examples in nature where that actually happens to organisms whose anatomy is as complicated as ours. And I'll give you a good example, which is that salamanders, which are vertebrates, they have spinal cord, they have limbs that are not too dissimilar from yours and mine. Now, you can take a salamander's arm and cut it off, and you think that's it because, you know, they're so complex, they're toast. They're going to now be a three-legged creature instead of a quadruped, right? Well, remarkably enough, that's not a deterrent. This amputated limb will actually regrow. The animal will be able to regrow this appendage in essentially approximately 60 days, and it will be functionally reintegrated to the pre-existing body such that the animal can actually use it. And the mystery for us is that we don't understand why some animals have kept this capacity and other organisms have either a reduced activity or capacity to regenerate or have completely lost it altogether.
And when this lizard regrows its arm, does it regrow from the front or from the back? So I'm imagining if I lost my arm, would I sprout like a tiny little hand out of my shoulder and then it would like stretch out and get bigger? Or would it grow sort of from the shoulder out and then eventually there would be a hand at the end?
It's remarkable to watch this thing unfold in real time. It really is. So the first thing that happens after the amputation of the appendage is that you get this nondescript, almost like a dome of cells, which we refer to as a regeneration blastema. It's a structure that is present in essentially all organisms that regenerate missing body parts. And that's essentially just a dome of cells that are dividing. And what happens now is that they begin to regionalize that dome into specific locations of the axis of the arm. So the very, very tip of the dome will eventually become the fingers and the hand, right? And then towards beneath that, you begin to see where the wrist structure is going to be, where the forearm is going to be, and then eventually where the arm is going to be. So it actually reconstructs the final anatomy of the appendage even before the appendage is fully finished. And now what happens, which is the second part of your question, is that, yes, you end up with a relatively small structure. Small enough that it will be laughable to regenerate something that tiny when the animal is already an adult. And here's the other mystery of regeneration is that it does not have to wait as long as it takes for the baby arm to grow into an adult arm. It actually finds a way for that arm to reach a size that is appropriate to the size of the animal. So this regulation of scale and proportion is also a mystery in regeneration, which we really don't understand at all.
Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado is a molecular biologist at the Stowers Institute in Kansas City. Coming up, getting a better understanding of the emotion that fuels many comebacks, nostalgia.
Generally, nostalgia is defined as a kind of autobiographical memory.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about comebacks. Deep in the desert of Israel, not much grows without a lot of effort. Far from the sandy beaches of the Mediterranean and the nightlife of Tel Aviv, the Negev makes up about half of Israel's land. It was part of the ancient spice route, where 2,000 years ago, the Nabataeans brought frankincense and myrrh from Egypt to Mediterranean ports. Along the way, they established irrigation systems, and they grew grapes. Today, farmers are engineering a comeback for those ancient vineyards. Susan Phillips reports.
Hello. How are you?
Shalom. Aaron Fate is an associate professor at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, and he's showing me around an experimental vineyard. The sun is blistering. There is no shade anywhere, and the hot wind blows in our faces.
Are you okay if we do a little walk? Yes? Okay.
Aaron says viticulture, the act of growing grapes for wine, began in this region thousands of years ago. Even though the area gets almost no rain, just about 4 inches a year.
The Nabataeans didn't have water and still were making a lot of wine here.
The Nabataeans were a nomadic tribe that lived in this area about 2,500 years ago. They built stone walls or terraces to capture what little rain did fall. So during downpours, the water got absorbed by the ground instead of bouncing off the tough, salty soil.
Now, another challenge of a desert environment, sunlight. Sunlight is a bad beast, indeed.
Aaron is originally from Italy, where wine is grown like this.
There is a main shoot and then the two branches of the vine. So the vine is kind of put like Jesus Christ, sort of, like this. It's crucified, totally crucified.
That way of growing grapes doesn't work in the Israeli desert.
Now, what is the problem here? This exposes the berries very much to sun radiation. In the morning, in the evening, you are always battered by the sun.
Which, he says, makes for some pretty bad wine.
The fruit becomes brown. Sunburns start to develop in both red and white varieties. You lose acidity, so you get these red wines that sit on your tongue like a stone. Not fun to drink them.
So instead, Aaron encourages farmers to grow the vines in a way that the leaves can create a canopy of sorts and shade the grapes from too much sun. We visit a farmer who works with Aaron.
We have here close to 24 hectares of vineyards.
His name is Iran Raz, but everyone calls him Nana. He owns Nana Estate Winery, and it's about a 10-minute drive from the Egyptian border. Nana's vineyard looks like a river of deep green that snakes through a valley of tan, brown, desolate earth.
The first year was quite tough because first when I came here, it was nothing here, just desert. No roads, no water system. I need to do everything by myself.
As Nana began to cultivate the land, he found history everywhere he looked, including the remnants of the ancient terraces built by the Nabataeans. And he learned from them. One day, a heavy rainfall replenished a dry stream bed known as a wadi.
And the rain fell very fast, and the water started to move very fast on the river. And I came one day after, and I saw that all the places that the terraces broke, okay, because it's built 2,000 years ago, and all these places, the soil moved with the water.
He watched as the water carried away the soil through the broken parts of the ancient terrace. Without those stone walls pulling the water, the rain bounced off the hard, dry soil.
So I understand how important it is to build again the terraces. So I built all the terraces here again.
Since then, he hasn't had any problems with runoff. But unlike the ancient Nabataeans, today, Nana can tap into a pipeline that brings desalinated seawater from a plant on the Mediterranean about 100 miles away. And that gives him a surprising advantage over traditional wineries. He gets so little rain that he has almost complete control over how much water his grapes get. During a wine tasting, Aaron Fett says that it's this water control that makes the wine here in Israel so good.
By the way, you are tasting now the best Shiraz I ever tasted, okay? Really. I mean, just close your eyes and taste the Shiraz. It really tastes differently.
Nana says he was drawn to grow grapes in this desolate environment because of its legacy.
It's got history. You can find in the Bible that people grow grapes and drink wine.
So, first wine that is from 100%.
That story was reported by Susan Phillips. We've been talking about comebacks, and many of them are driven by an emotion. Nostalgia. Lots of TV shows and ads are powered by nostalgia.
How can I handle work on a day like today?
Like this Ferris Bueller-inspired Honda commercial. What exactly is nostalgia? What does it do in our brains? We sent reporters Andreas Copes and Liz Tung to find out.
Nostalgia may be a savvy marketing tool these days, but it wasn't always that way. The term nostalgia was first coined back in 1688 by a Swiss medical student named Johannes Hofer. Hofer was an ambitious guy, so ambitious that he wanted to discover and name his own illness. And so in his student dissertation, Hofer describes a disease that basically amounts to intense and potentially deadly homesickness. He bases this idea on two case studies. One was a student who'd fallen sick while studying abroad and was sent home to die, only to make a miraculous recovery. The other was a local servant girl who became ill after an accident put her in a hospital far from home. Again, she recovered once she was back home with her parents. Hofer proposed that this wasn't a coincidence, but rather the result of a disease that he named nostalgia, from the Greek roots nostos, meaning homecoming, and algos, which means pain. To Hofer, this wasn't just an emotional illness. It was physical. News of this new disease spread across Switzerland and eventually across the world, becoming known as the Swiss disease. As we learn more about the body, nostalgia went from being thought of as a physical illness to a psychological one. And finally, it morphed into how we think of it today. Here's neuroscientist Andrew Newberg.
Generally, nostalgia is defined as a kind of autobiographical memory, thinking about something in your own past, that typically evokes a primarily positive kind of emotional response. Although, you know, there's always a little bit of a negative, bittersweet kind of thing, longing for, you know, something in the past.
But overall, nostalgia is seen as a positive emotion.
That actually helps people to be more resilient, to kind of think back on what their life has been up till this point and give them some purpose and meaning going forward.
So we sent our intern, Andreas Copes, out to experience some nostalgia. And Andreas, where did you go?
So even though I'm a child of the 90s, you know, I grew up with NSYNC and the Furbies, Titanic, I love the 1980s. The music, the fashion, everything about it. So I visited a 1980s escape room in Philadelphia. And Elizabeth Garson, the founder of Escape the 1980s, gave me a tour.
So yeah, so what we see in here is a very old school video store.
Like the Blockbuster.
It is like Blockbuster, yeah. And there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of video tapes, VHS tapes.
For example?
So here we have Moonstruck or Top Gun. Here's Cocktail, Beverly Hills Cop, Turner and Hooch, Can't Buy Me Love, Dirty Dancing, Lethal Weapon. We even have offbeat ones like Blue Velvet.
all neatly organized into categories like customer favorites or new releases. I opened the videotapes and put them into a VCR to find clues like this one from the Neverending Story. I asked Elizabeth Garson why she chose the 1980s.
Because it was one of the best eras of all times. And because it appeals to my generation, which is Generation X, but it also really appeals to the following generation, to the millennial generation.
How did you feel when you were at the escape room?
It was super cool and it made me feel comfortable and I could forget about the stress every day, the news that I read. And for the next few days, I was listening to my 80s playlist 24/7, like Heaven is a Place on Earth, for example.
Okay, so when you hear that song or watch an old movie, what creates that emotion? That sappy, sad, sweet feeling? Neuroscientist Andrew Newberg explains it like this.
It evokes memory areas of our brain, and these tend to be located in a part of our brain called the temporal parietal region. So the temporal lobe is along the side of the brain, the parietal lobe is in the back of the brain, and where the two come together is where we have a lot of our memory processes. And so when brain scans have been done on people experiencing nostalgia, that's an area of the brain that becomes active.
So it's about memory, but it's also about emotions.
What links the emotion to the memory is another part of our brain called the insula.
The insula seems to be involved not so much in the actual feeling of emotions, but in trying to help us understand them.
It's like the translator between our emotional minds and our rational minds. Andrew says there's also evidence that dopamine, the feel-good molecule in our brain, is released when we feel nostalgic. So it's no coincidence that marketers tap into this emotion when figuring out how to sell us their products. Case in point, this little Stranger Things ditty that was released to advertise new Coke.
Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Steve.
You're late. Coca-Cola is
it. Here's Jonah Berger. He's a marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
I think people are always interested in harkening back to a simple time. It reminds them and connects them to things that they've loved in the past. And so it's an interesting way for marketers to stay relevant today.
And you know what? It happens with every new generation. Jonah says that people in the 1980s were nostalgic for the 1950s.
Every generation says, oh, you know, today things are so complicated and busy and young people, they're so into new technologies and, you know, things are so much different than the simple ways of the past. And so the idea of hearkening back to a simple time, a simpler time, hearkening back to when people were younger, when things, life seemed easier.
That was the case with this guy I talked to named Sean Robert. He runs an 80s nostalgia website, and he told me it all started back when he was in his early 20s, and life was tough.
I was working two jobs to make ends meet, and it just seemed like I was sort of like a cog in a machine.
He wanted to build what he calls a happy place for himself, filled with all the cartoons and movies and toys and even cereals that he loved as a kid.
The idea was that it would be like an archive of all kinds of like 80s era kid stuff and stuff that I could share.
13 years later, the site's still going strong. Sean made friends through the website, even met his wife, and it made him feel better. But Sean says he realizes there's an irony to all of this.
There's this undercurrent of sadness that defines nostalgia. The whole idea of nostalgia is this want or need for something that you can't have anymore. When you start accepting the fact that you can't go back, or that this sadness is the way it's supposed to be, I guess, that's when it becomes a little bit more gratifying.
That story was reported by Liz Tung and Andreas Copes. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Special thanks to Ben Gross at the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City for his input on this episode. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Andreas Copes is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. But you left me wounded in the doorway.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.